narrower grounds. It is all the more distressing that our colleagues have manufactured a facial challenge because the parties have advanced numerous ways to resolve the case that would facilitate electioneering by nonprofit advocacy corporations such as Citizens United without toppling statutes and precedents. Which is to say, the majority has transgressed yet another cardinal principle of the judicial process. If it is not necessary to decide more, it is necessary not to decide more. Consider just three of the narrower grounds of decision that the majority has bypassed. First, the court could have ruled on statutory grounds that a feature-length film distributed through video on demand does not qualify as an electioneering communication under Section 203 of BCRA. BCRA defines that term to encompass certain communications transmitted by broadcast, cable, or satellite. When Congress was developing BCRA, the video on demand medium was still in its infancy, and legislators were focused on a very different sort of programming, short advertisements run on television and radio. The sponsors of BCRA acknowledge that the FEC's implementing regulations do not clearly apply to video on demand transmissions. In light of this ambiguity, the distinctive characteristics of video on demand and the elementary rule that every reasonable construction must be resorted to in order to save a statute from unconstitutionality, the court could have reasonably ruled that Section 203 does not apply to Hillary. Second, the court could have expanded the MCFL exemption to cover Section 501c4 nonprofits that accept only a de minimis amount of money from for-profit corporations. Citizens United professes to be such a group. It says it is funded predominantly by donations from individuals who support its ideological message. Numerous courts of appeal have held that de minimis business support does not, in itself, remove an otherwise qualifying organization from the ambit of MCFL. This court could have simply followed their lead. Finally, let us not forget Citizens United's as-applied constitutional challenge. Precisely because Citizens United looks so much like the MCFL organizations we've exempted from regulation, while a feature-length video on demand film looks so unlike the types of electoral advocacy Congress has found deserving of regulation, this challenge is a substantial one. As the appellant's own arguments show, the court could have easily limited the breadth of its constitutional holding had it declined to adopt the novel notion that speakers and speech acts must always be treated identically and always spared expenditures restrictions in the political realm. Yet the court nonetheless turns its back on the as-applied review process that has been a staple of campaign finance litigation since Buckley versus Vallejo, 1976, and it was affirmed and expanded just two terms ago in WRTL. This brief tour of alternative grounds on which the case could have been decided is not meant to show that any of these grounds is ideal, though each is perfectly valid. It is meant to show that there were principled, narrower paths that a court that was serious about judicial restraint could have taken. There was also the straightforward path, applying Austin and McConnell just as the district court did in holding that the funding of Citizens United's film can be regulated under them. The only thing preventing the majority from affirming the district court or adopting a narrower ground that would retain Austin is its disdain for Austin. Part two. The final principle of judicial process that the majority violates is the most transparent, stare decisis. I am not an absolutist when it comes to stare decisis in the campaign finance area or any other. No one is. But if this principle is to do any meaningful work in supporting the rule of law, it must at least demand a significant justification beyond the preferences of five justices for overturning settled doctrine. A decision to overrule should rest on some special reason over and above the belief that a prior case was wrongly decided. No such justification exists in this case, and to the contrary, there are powerful prudential reasons to keep faith with our precedents. The court's central argument for why stare decisis ought to be trumped is that it does not like Austin. The opinion was not well reasoned, our colleagues assert, and it conflicts with First Amendment principles. This, of course, is the court's merits argument, the many defects in which we will soon consider. I'm perfectly willing to concede that if one of our precedents were dead wrong in its reasoning or irreconcilable with the rest of our doctrine, there would be a compelling basis for revisiting it. But neither is true of Austin, as I explain at length in parts 3 and 4, infra, and restating a merits argument with additional vigor does not give it an extra weight in the stare decisis calculus. Perhaps in recognition of this point, the court supplements its merits case with a spattering of assertions. The court proclaims that Austin is undermined by experience since its announcement. This is a curious claim to make in a case that lacks a developed record. The majority has no empirical evidence with which to substantiate the claim. We just have its ipsy dixit that the real world has not been kind to Austin. Nor does the majority bother to specify in what sense Austin has been undermined. Instead, it treats the reader to a string of non sequiturs. Our nation's speech dynamic is changing. Speakers have become adept at presenting citizens with sound bites, talking points, and scripted messages. Corporations do not have monolithic views. How any of these ruminations weakens the force of stare decisis escapes my comprehension. The majority also contends that the government's hesitation to rely on Austin's anti-distortion rationale diminishes the principle of adhering to that precedent. Why it diminishes the value of stare decisis is left unexplained. We have never thought fit to overrule a precedent because a litigant has taken any particular tack, nor should we. Our decisions can often be defended on multiple grounds, and a litigant may have strategic or case-specific reasons for emphasizing only a subset of them. Members of the public, moreover, often rely on our bottom-line holdings far more than on our precise legal arguments. Surely this is true for the legislatures that have been regulating corporate electioneering since Austin. The task of evaluating the continued viability of precedents falls to this court, not to the parties. Although the majority opinion spends several pages making these surprising arguments, it says almost nothing about the standard considerations we have used to determine stare decisis value, such as the antiquity of the precedent, the workability of its legal rule, and the reliance interests at stake. It is also conspicuously silent about McConnell, even though the McConnell Court's decision to uphold BCRA Section 203 relied not only on the anti-distortion logic of Austin, but also on the statute's historical pedigree and the need to preserve the integrity of federal campaigns. We have recognized that stare decisis has special force when legislators or citizens have acted in reliance on a previous decision, for in this instance, overruling the decision would dislodge settled rights and expectations or require an extensive legislative response. Stare decisis protects not only personal rights involving property or contract, but also the ability of the elected branches to shape their laws in an effective and coherent fashion. Today's decision takes away a power that we have long permitted these branches to exercise. State legislatures have relied on their authority to regulate corporate electioneering, confirmed in Austin, for more than a century. The federal Congress has relied on this authority for a comparable stretch of time, and it specifically relied on Austin throughout the years it spent developing and debating BCRA. The total record it compiled was 100,000 pages long. Pulling out the rug beneath Congress after affirming the constitutionality of Section 203 6 years ago shows great disrespect for a co-equal branch. By removing one of its central components, today's ruling makes a hash out of BCRA's delicate and interconnected regulatory scheme. Consider just one example of the distortions that will follow. Political parties are barred under BCRA from soliciting or spending soft money, funds that are not subject to the statute's disclosure requirements or its source and amount limitations. Going forward, corporations and unions will be free to spend as much general treasury money as they wish on ads that support or attack specific candidates, whereas national parties will not be able to spend a dime of soft money on ads of any kind. The court's ruling thus dramatically enhances the role of corporations and unions and the narrow interests they represent, vis-a-vis the role of political parties and the broad coalitions they represent in determining who will hold public office. Beyond the reliance interests at stake, the other stare decisis factors also cut against the court. Considerations of antiquity are significant for similar reasons. McConnell is only 6 years old, but Austin has been on the books for two decades, and many of the statutes called into question by today's opinion have been on the books for half a century or more. The court points to no intervening change in circumstances that warrants revisiting Austin. Certainly nothing relevant has changed since we decided WRTL two terms ago. And the court gives no reason to think that Austin and McConnell are unworkable. In fact, no one has argued to us that Austin's rule has proved impracticable, and not a single for-profit corporation, union, or state has asked us to overrule it. Quite to the contrary, leading groups representing the business community, organized labor, and the nonprofit sector, together with more than half of the states, urge that we preserve Austin. As for McConnell, the portions of BCRA it upheld may be prolix, but all three branches of government have worked to make Section 203 as user-friendly as possible. For instance, Congress established a special mechanism for expedited review of constitutional challenges. The FEC has established a standardized process with clearly defined safe harbors for corporations to claim that a particular electioneering communication is permissible under WRTL. And as noted above, the Chief Justice crafted his controlling opinion in WRTL with the expressed goal of maximizing clarity and administrability. The case for stare decisis may be bolstered, we have said, when subsequent rulings have reduced the impact of a precedent while reaffirming the decision's core ruling. In the end, the court's rejection of Austin and McConnell comes down to nothing more than its disagreement with their results. Virtually every one of its arguments was made and rejected in those cases, and the majority opinion is essentially an amalgamation of resuscitated dissents. The only relevant thing that has changed since Austin and McConnell is the composition of this court. Today's ruling thus strikes at the vitals of stare decisis, the means by which we ensure that the law will not merely change erratically, but will develop in a principled and intelligible fashion that permits society to presume that bedrock principles are founded in the law rather than in the proclivities of individuals.